The headlines: Iran foreign minister proposes establishing a collective security mechanism to coordinate counterterrorism policies by Afghanistan's neighbors. Israeli forces stage a deadly attack on the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank, killing 3 Palestinians and injuring 15 others. And also in our headlines, the International Monetary Fund warns that the financial sanctions against Russia could make the U.S. dollar a less dominant currency. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's foreign minister says the long-time occupation of Afghanistan, as well as the wrong policies adopted by its occupiers, including the U.S., is the root cause of the problems gripping the country. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the invasion of Afghanistan did not contribute to its development or progress. Rather, it resulted in the current dire humanitarian situation. The top diplomat also warned against the threat of terrorism in Afghanistan, saying it could be traced to Washington. He proposed that a clear security mechanism be devised either by the existing organizations or an independent body in order to coordinate anti-terrorism policies. The Iranian foreign minister also called on the international community, especially neighboring countries, to join hands to ensure stability and security in Afghanistan. Amir Abdullahian made the comments in a speech at the third meeting of Afghanistan neighbors in China. Tehran reacting to Washington's announcement that it will impose new sanctions on Iranian nationals. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says the move is yet another indication of the U.S. government's malice toward Iranian people. According to the official, the move is a continuation of the White House's failed maximum pressure policy. Khatibzadeh said Washington's announcement of new sanctions clearly proves that it seizes every opportunity to level baseless accusations and put pressure on the Iranian people. He also noted that U.S. Claims it's prepared to return to its commitments under the 2015 deal with Iran, but at the same time it keeps violating the agreement and the Security Council resolution endorsing the deal. Fresh violence erupting in the occupied territories. Hours ago, Israeli military forces staged a deadly attack on the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank. Forces riding in dozens of military vehicles stormed into the camp. Israeli snipers opened fire on the Palestinian residents from rooftops. The health ministry says at least 3 Palestinians have been killed and 15 others injured. An Israeli soldier has reportedly been injured as well. Meanwhile, Israeli forces say they've shot dead a Palestinian after he injured 4 Israelis in a stabbing attack near Beit Lahm. The Islamic Jihad movement says it's mobilizing the Al-Quds Brigade's forces in response to the Israeli violence. There's been a fresh escalation in tensions across the occupied territories. On Tuesday night, a Palestinian man was gunned down after shooting dead 5 Israelis in a suburb of Tel Aviv. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joins us now from Brussels. Mr. Magnier, welcome to the program. Give us your perspective, please, on the recent escalation of tensions across the occupied territory at this moment.
Thank you very much. It doesn't start from what the Palestinians and the Israelis are doing today and how they are clashing. It starts from 1948 when the Israelis occupied Palestine, and then in 1967 when the Israelis captured East Jerusalem and the West Bank. And because the international community is just turning blind eye on what's happening in 70 years, and suddenly the conscience is waking up in what's happening in Ukraine. Well, what we have seen in the recent event, what's happening in Palestine, is how the Palestinians, who supposed to be living among the Israelis, are showing how the cause of the Palestinian people has never been completely crushed and forgotten. Palestinian from Jenin and Palestinian from the occupied territory buying weapons from their own pocket to respond against the Israelis, and just for their voice to be heard that the Palestinian cause has been treated unfairly throughout the decades without the international community, including the Palestinian Authority led by President Abu Mazen, are oppressing the Palestinians and just not giving them their right back.
Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, thank you. Meantime, Palestinian resistance groups are calling on political factions to overcome divisions and adopt a unified strategy to resist the Israeli regime. In a statement issued on the occasion of the Land Day in Palestine, resistance groups have said political factions need to follow the lead of the Palestinian people who are united in resisting the Israeli occupation, settlement expansions, and racial discrimination. They've also criticized a recent meeting in the Naqab Desert between Israeli officials and foreign ministers from several Arab countries. The resistance groups say those Arab governments need to fulfill their responsibility towards the Palestinian people and stop the Israeli crimes instead of racing to meet with Israeli officials. People in Gaza and the West Bank commemorated Land Day on Wednesday. Members and supporters of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas have held a ceremony in southern Lebanon to mark the 46th anniversary of Land Day in Palestine. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh took part in the event and filed this report for us.
Islamic resistance movement Hamas in Lebanon held a mass rally to commemorate Land Day in the southern town of Saida. Hamas leaders considered this event as an occasion not only to remember Palestine, but a day to resist.
Land Day has become more significant with the qualitative operations which are occurring in Palestine, especially the last operation, which is the slogan for the upcoming phase. This will be the state of Palestinians in the West Bank, in Al-Quds, in the lands of 1948, the state of declared and continuous struggle against the Zionist enemy, backed by a capable resistance in Gaza. Land Day this year is being commemorated with an aroma of victory, of heroic endeavors to prove that the land is ours.
Hamas also says Israeli policies of annexing land and building settlements have not stopped the Palestinian nationals from their struggle.
Today, the Palestinian people and behind them, the Palestinian resistance, are sending a message to the Zionist entity that Palestinian land will not change its identity. This land will remain Palestinian, Arab and Muslim, and the Zionist occupation, with all its crimes and swallowing of more land and building settlements, will not be able to change the national identity of Palestine.
Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, many of whom were born and raised in Lebanon, say they grow more attached to Palestine day by day. Every generation becomes even more determined to return.
In the Meya Meya refugee camp in Saida, the youth, the men and women, everyone were joyous and cheering after they heard of the excellent operation. They were even saying that liberation is near and that Eid has come earlier this year. This was the situation in all the camps, and this proves that day by day our children, women and men are attached to the land of Palestine and have more hope in liberation.
Speakers at the rally stressed that the resistance in Palestine is stronger than ever, with the support it has from the entire resistance alliance in the region.
Land Day is commemorated by Palestinians all over the world as a pivotal date to mark their attachment to their land. With recent unprecedented events, the people's resistance, even in land occupied by Israel in 1948, is growing more vibrant, making the dream of liberating Palestine more possible than any time in the past. Mariam Saleh, South Lebanon.
Moscow's military operation is now in its fifth week, and Ukraine says its forces are preparing to ward off new Russian attacks in the east. According to President Volodymyr Zelensky, Moscow is building up troops in the east after suffering setbacks near the capital, Kiev. Russia says it's now focusing on the liberation of the Donbass region as Ukraine's military capacity has been seriously degraded. At peace talks held in Istanbul this week, Moscow pledged to curtail operations near Kiev and the northern city of Chernihiv to build trust. But Ukraine dismisses Russia's de-escalation as a ploy to stem its losses and prepare for other attacks. Meanwhile, Russia's defense ministry has announced a local ceasefire Thursday to allow civilians to be evacuated from the besieged city of Mariupol. But Kiev rejects the proposal as just another manipulation. The UN says more than 4 million Ukrainians have fled the war in the past weeks. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says Western states should intensify sanctions against Russia until it withdraws all its forces from Ukraine. Speaking at a parliament hearing, Johnson said lifting G7 sanctions simply in return for a Russian ceasefire in Ukraine would go, quote, straight into Putin's playbook. He said London was looking at increasing its military aid to Ukraine, including providing armored personnel carriers. The premier, however, ruled out giving Ukraine the equivalent of NATO's Article 5, which says an attack on one member is an attack on all. Following recent peace talks between Ukraine and Russia, reports suggested the UK, France, and the United States could sign up to guarantee Ukraine's security in return for a Russian pullout. Johnson also stressed that the UK government does not seek regime change in Russia. Meanwhile, Ukrainian security officials said Kiev would impose sanctions on companies that work with Russia's military-industrial complex. Germany says Russia has told Chancellor Olaf Scholz that European countries could continue to pay for Russian gas in euros and not rubles. As previously announced, a German government spokesman said Russian President Vladimir Putin has told Scholz that payments for Russian gas from Europe next month would continue to be in euros. He said the gas price will be transferred as usual to the Gazprom bank, which is not affected by Western sanctions. The bank will then convert the payments into rubles. The Kremlin, however, says Putin told Scholz that Moscow's demand for gas price payment in rubles should not lead to, quote, worsening of contractual terms for European importers. Berlin says Scholz has asked Moscow for information in writing to better understand the payment procedure. Putin said last week that Moscow would begin only accepting rubles as payment for natural gas deliveries to, quote, unfriendly countries. The Russian demand was rejected by Europeans as well as the G7 group, arguing it is a clear breach of existing contracts. Staying with news about the economic fallout of the Ukraine conflict, the International Monetary Fund is warning that the financial sanctions against Russia could make the U.S. dollar a less dominant currency. IMF Deputy Director Geeta Gopinath says the Western sanctions could result in a more fragmented international monetary system that might lead states toward using digital finances such as cryptocurrencies or stable coins. According to the IMF official, using other currencies in global trade could push national central banks to diversify their reserve assets. It was a trip that was supposed to be felt with praise and applause for British royals Prince William and his wife, but the opposite occurred. Their trip, called the Caribbean Charm Offensive, lost its charm as people there protested their presence. Although the protests against the royals were not new, this time it was different.
The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge have concluded week-long tour of the Caribbean. The trip was to mark the Queen's Platinum Jubilee this year and saw William and Catherine also visit Jamaica and Bahamas. But the tour was marred by a series of gaffes and protests by local people over the visit. As the tour progressed, it became increasingly clear that a trip intended to show the royals as empathetic and in touch was sparking the totally opposite reaction.
The trip of the British royals to the Caribbean and Central America reflects the broader colonial relationship that the United Kingdom has had with the region. Countries like Jamaica, Trinidad, Belize, Barbados, so many others, Guyana in the region, that have been colonized and enslaved by British bankers, by a British royal family for centuries.
When William and Kate greeted cheering children by a football pitch who were standing behind a wire fence, the resulting imagery created a deeply uncomfortable look for the monarchy. And when they deliberately recreated the Queen and Prince Philip's journey on a Land Rover from decades ago, the wistful nod to a bygone era struck an odd tone in a country looking to move forward, not back. Earlier in the tour, William was forced to tackle Britain's historic role in the slave trade, expressing his sorrow that it ever happened. The move came following anti-colonial protests in Jamaica and Belize, but William fell short of a full apology. Jamaican President Andrew Holness said they will push for the island to be a republic with a referendum this year. Protesters outside the British High Commission in Jamaica handed over a letter signed by a group of 100 prominent individuals from Jamaica's Advocates Network, calling for an apology and recognition of the need for atonement and reparations.
And so what the peoples of the Caribbean and also other places colonized by England are demanding is reparations. I think this is exactly what they mean by atonement, by paying for the sins of colonization and imperialism. We know that Barbados, Haiti, and so many other Caribbean countries, the sugar that was produced in those nations in the 1800s was worth millions today.
The reasons behind the people's anger in places like Jamaica were pure and simple, yet filled with decades of hate. For the first time, images of glamorous royals smiling while seeing local life could not erase dissenting voices about monarchy and colonialism. The Jamaican Prime Minister said the royals' presence allowed unresolved issues to be put front and center, adding that Jamaica was moving on.
The United Kingdom has a dark colonial past in many different places of the world, including the Caribbean. The UK institutionalized a slave trade between the Caribbean, Africa, and London, stealing the wealth of its colonies to enrich itself. London, Bristol, and Liverpool, which were hubs of the slave trade, became wealthy and powerful. Britain formally abolished the slave trade in 1807, but only outlawed the slavery in 1834, after the Slavery Abolition Act was passed by the Parliament the year before.
And actually, millions of dollars of wealth from the Caribbean in sugar, in tobacco, in alcohol was extracted during the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, up until the 1900s, when many of these nations won independence from the crown.
The British government paid the slave traders £20 million in compensation, 40% of its budget. That is some £17 billion. The government took out a loan to pay it, which was only paid off by British taxpayer money in 2015. That means the British government, using public money, paid slave owners, but not those who were enslaved. Britain's colonial past and its treatment of former colonies and the residents have raised harsh criticism.
And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth, in order to maximize their profits. And what the Crown represents is exactly this.
The Commonwealth Nations, which was created after the first half of the 20th century, after decolonization of the British Empire, is a dark reminiscent of British past. And now calls are growing to abolish the institution.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Nowruz in Travelogues. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Nowruz has impacted foreign travelers and tourists so deeply that many of them have prepared accounts on what they had seen in Iran during this ancient feast. As it was said in the previous episode, many of these foreigners were politicians and spies who have registered their experiences of Nowruz in Iran in order to get familiar with every minute custom among Iranians. This has been done to pave the way for cultural colonialism. Today, we are going to touch upon the accounts of some other foreigners who have ridden on Nowruz in Iran. Stay tuned, please. Among various sources on Nowruz in Iran, the book At the Presence of Sultan Sahib Qaran more descriptively deals with this issue. The writer of the book is Heinrich Karl Brusch, German traveler of the 19th century. He has registered his findings on Nowruz during the reign of Nasser al-Din Shah Qajar, known as Sultan Sahib Qaran. He writes, Nowruz feast was near. The word Nowruz is for almost all Iranians a magic and miraculous word. With hearing the word, the hearts beat and faces smile, and in the hope of a better future in the coming Nowruz, they tolerate all their present hardships and problems, and they wish for the coming of Nowruz in the whole year. Brusch has pointed to the long history of Nowruz. He continues, Nowruz coincides with the end of winter and the turn of zodiac pieces and a start of a spring. The prevalence of astrology and astronomy during the reign of Nasser al-Din Shah Qajar had attracted the German traveler, as he writes elsewhere in his book. Iranian astronomers look for auspicious and inauspicious hours and get good wages by determining these hours for the king and princes. From a few days before Nowruz, they try to determine the time of the sun's turn to pieces with the exactness of seconds and announce it to enable people to do their traditional ceremonies. German traveler of the 19th century, Heinrich Karl Brusch, writes in his accounts on Nowruz, confectionaries have prospered and they supply different kinds of original Iranian sweets. This traveler continues, for Nowruz feast, Iranians usually grow flowers in their small homes or vases, which begin with the letter S, including sumbul, meaning hyacinth. This way, they celebrate the awakening of the nature after a long winter sleep. Brusch narrates on the Qajarid king's presence in Buzar before Nowruz, writing, as the king intended to go to bazaar, Sabze Meydan Square would be cordoned off and nobody was allowed to enter. Only the Shah's entourage and courtiers were allowed to enter. The book of the German traveler says that the two kinds of greetings, namely the minor greeting and the public greeting, were among the requirements of Nowruz. Minor greeting belonged to family and relatives and was done on the 1st of Farvardin, in the interior of Royal Citadel. But public greeting was done differently. The Shah would sit on the throne at the porch of the tall palace, looming over the large yard near the square so that he could see everyone in the large yard. This porch had long and large curtains, which would be drawn away. The participants of the public greeting, including officers, high-ranking officials, the nobility, clergymen, VIPs, and princes, who would line up in different places, which had already been determined to see the Shah with pomp and glory. British diplomat Robert Kerr Porter, some 200 years ago, had traveled to Iran. He writes in 1819 on what he had seen in Tehran during Nowruz. I arrived in Arg Square on the first day of Nowruz feast. People were there from every group and class. After the entrance door, I entered the interior of Arg, where the Shah would receive his subjects. After a while, I was in the enclosure of the palace. The Shah came and sat on the throne. The attending nobility congratulated him and received their gift, and the ceremony was ended. Karsten Nebhur was a German tourist and cartographer who traveled to Iran during the Zandiyeh rule. He was one of the few travelers who have written unbiased accounts on Iranian customs and traditions. Nebhur writes in 1765, on March 19th, I was drawing at home. Villagers thought that I was making preparations for Nowruz feast. The Iranian Nowruz is the day that has existed in the ancient era. The German tourist continues, on March 20th, corresponding with Farvardin I, villagers had put on better clothes and they didn't work on this day. Wearing better clothes and not working were the only things that this day was a feast, and since it was the month of Ramadan, they were not allowed to eat anything in daytime. Of course, at night, they compensated for the day's fasting, but in full calm and tranquility. Interestingly, most travelers wrote their accounts on Nowruz when the feast coincided with the month of Ramadan or Muharram. Thus, they would witness that people would observe religious rituals and would prefer them to national customs and feasts. Frederick Charles Richards was an American who had traveled to Iran during the rule of Reza Khan Pahlavi. In part of his book on Nowruz, he writes, Iranians believe in this old tradition that anyone who, before speaking a word, eats something sweet in the morning of Nowruz and oils his body, no bad incident will occur to him. Nearly all people go to bath and put on new clothes. Richards points to Nowruz customs in Isfahan and writes, when the ceremonies of mourning of Nowruz end, those people of Isfahan who are able rush toward to the river Zayanderu to stay there till afternoon and evening. They have adhered to the custom of narration and reciting of Shahnameh and the story of Rostam and Sohrab, and they are engaged in singing around the historical bridges of Isfahan at the banks of Zayanderu.
Spotlight. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli forces have raided a Palestinian village home to a man who has shot several Israelis in Tel Aviv. The forces clashed with residents and arrested members of the man's family. The 26-year-old Palestinian man gunned down five Israelis, including a military officer, in a suburb of Tel Aviv on Tuesday. Resistance groups regard the attack a natural response and a heroic operation retaliation for the crimes committed by the Tel Aviv regime. In recent weeks, more and more Palestinians in different parts of the occupied territories have been targeted by Israeli forces. There have also been several attacks on Palestinians in the Negev by unknown Jewish groups. Now, what's next for Palestinians? What option do they have to deal with the violence and treason of some Arab states?
A natural and legitimate response to Israeli crimes in the occupied territories. This is how Palestinian resistance groups praised the deadly shooting spree that left five Israelis dead in the Haredi ultra-Orthodox city of Bnei Barak, one of Tel Aviv's suburbs, on Tuesday night. The operation was carried out by 27-year-old Diya Hamarshi from Yabat town near Jenin, northern the occupied West Bank. Hamarshi was shot dead during the clashes. Both resistance groups, Hamas and al-Jihad, in addition to other Palestinian factions, had welcomed the incident.
These operations are part of the Palestinian people's struggle and resistance. We are speaking about an increase of operations and acts against the Israeli forces since the beginning of the year. In one way or another, it's related to the fighting status and last year's Sword of Al-Quds battle. But also there are numerous factors that naturally lead to counter-violence used by Israel. Provocations at Al-Aqsa Mosque, the settlement activity, and settlers' aggression, discrimination, and violence against Palestinians in lands occupied in 1948.
Israeli military decided to bolster its troops in the occupied West Bank and border areas with four additional battalions. In addition, two battalions will be sent to reinforce troops in the Gaza Strip envelope area. Israeli forces raided Yabat town and stormed Hamarshi's home. Large crowds gathered and clashes erupted between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers. Hamarshi's family members were questioned, and at least 30 Palestinians were detained in Yabat and other areas.
Israel is threatening to do what it's already doing, which is oppression of the Palestinian people and continuation of occupation and the apartheid racial system of discrimination. Any more escalation will only complicate the situation more. What should be clear here, especially after the Negev meeting, that nobody can marginalize the Palestinian issue, and that the Palestinian issue is the central issue of this region.
Tuesday's operation marked the third deadly operation in lands occupied in 1948 in Israel in a week, bringing the combined death toll to 11 Israelis, excluding Palestinian perpetrators. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett vowed that Israel will fight what he described as terrorism with an iron fist. Israeli military officials warned that Tel Aviv's shooting and the recent operations in Umm al-Fahm and Bir al-Sabah could lead to copycat attacks. Palestinians, however, reiterate that such incidents are a normal response to Israeli crimes and violence in the occupied territories. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our panelists in today's episode of Spotlight. Richard Becker, anti-war activist with the Answer Coalition, and also the author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire, out of San Francisco. Also joining us will be Khaled Barakat, journalist and activist in Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. My first question for Richard, in your opinion, Richard, what's responsible for this rising violence and escalation that I've been witnessing recently in the occupied territories?
Well, you know, the way that the media reports in the United States is that violence only takes place when there are acts of resistance by Palestinians. But every day, the violence is going on against the Palestinian people in the West Bank. Gaza, of course, a giant open-air prison with steadily declining living standards for the people who live there. But every day, the settlers and the occupation forces in the West Bank carry out acts of brutality and often murder against Palestinians, but that doesn't show up in the media in the United States. And of course, It is the oppression, this long-term oppression and repression of the Palestinian people, which is going to bring about all kinds of resistance, some of it in an organized way by organizations, some of it individual acts. It's impossible to have the situation go on the way that it is now and the way that it has been for many years and many decades and not see all kinds of acts of resistance take place.
Now let me turn to Vancouver. Khaled, the Palestinian assailants and even some who pose no threat, they get gunned down by Israeli forces regularly. But how come their homes come under attack? I mean, why are their family members arrested?
Well, this is a practice that Israel do on a daily basis, and that it's the collective punishment. When they arrest a Palestinian, they made sure to terrorize the entire neighborhood and the village. And this is a daily life of Palestinians under occupation for the past 74 years. So it's, and we don't want to get used to it. We are going to resist that. The natural thing for Palestinians is to actually resist occupation, resist colonization and apartheid. And, these escalations that they are talking about is happening inside 1948 occupied territories, or what they call Israel, which means that the Israelis are witnessing also a new phenomena. They cannot have a free hand in oppressing our people inside Israel the same way they do in the West Bank and Gaza. Last May, Israel killed over 500 Palestinians in Gaza with U.S.-made, weapons, and the world was silent. And for Palestinians to resist that, it becomes, a concern by the United States. Actually, the U.S. is responsible on Israel crimes and what Israel is doing, and they're providing not just the military and political supports for them, but as Richard mentioned, they are absolutely fabricating these stories and lies in U.S. media, and that's something also we know why they do that. But absolutely, we are going to witness a rise in the Palestinian resistance, especially in the holy month of Ramadan, and Israel now needs to understand that they cannot keep confiscating Palestinian lands and demolishing their homes and then expect Palestinians to be silenced. The other issue is the political issue in the region. When this, the shame of summit that happened in Naqab, where Arab reactionary regimes and Israel are meeting in Palestine to declare basically a coalition, that's not normalization, that's building a coalition.
Khaled, we'll come to that later in the show. Okay. Now let me go to Richard and ask him this question. Richard, resistance movements regard attacks like the one that we're discussing today as a natural response to the Israeli crimes committed against them. Do you agree?
Well, when you actually witness, and I have just very briefly been able to witness, the kind of day-to-day brutality against the population, against the Palestinians, and as Khaled says, inside 48, there is resistance and oppression as well. But when you see the situation, you actually see it. I mean, I think most people who go from the United States, and even if they think they have an understanding of how bad it is, and the apartheid regime, and the police and settler repression, and so forth, no one can really grasp it until you see it. And of course, you can't really grasp it until you live it. But when you see it, it's just shocking. The level of brutality against the Palestinian population at the hands of the Israeli military, and even more so at the hands of the settlers. And the way that their reactions are by the authorities there, like there's just a story in the media from there a few days ago about how a man is assaulted by Israeli settlers, five or six of them. He's beaten, and he fights back, and then he's arrested, and the settlers are let go. This is a day-to-day, I am not exaggerating, when the attacks by the settlers take place, these fascist settlers, and I use the word fascist advisedly, these fascist settlers, they chop down the olive trees, they assault people, they attack their homes, they attack people in cars, and the Israeli military, which is right there, either does nothing or joins with the settlers in the attack. So what do we think the population, how the population is going to respond to that?
Okay, Khaled, in multiple areas in the occupied lands, Palestinians these days feel more insecure, like Palestinians living in the Negev region. They're concerned about, you know, Jewish vigilante groups there. For instance, we have this Battle Rangers unit that's a civilian group launched by a former Israeli police officer who is claiming inadequate police governance in the southern region. So why should Tel Aviv allow such radical elements to threaten Palestinian lives? As an occupier, they're responsible for the security of those people, aren't they?
Absolutely, but Israel do that all the time. I mean, it was established by these militias, Zionist, you know, criminals, militias, and they kept, you know, the settlers, they're all armed. So the settlers are actually paramilitary kind of part of the security, part of Israel military presence in Palestine. And so when you see a colony or an Israeli settlement, this is not just, you know, people who are living there. They have, like, weapon storage rooms. They have military compounds. They have weapons. These are not, you know, neighborhoods, as Israel tried to put it, but it's actually a military compound. In fact, when they arrest Palestinians, sometimes they take them to these settlements first as, you know, a station on the road to prison. So Israel does that not just in the West Bank. It also do that in 1948 areas, and particularly in Al-Naqab, because also they want to oppress Palestinians without having any legal charges or accountability. At the same time, what Israel is doing in the Naqab is being not just the state oppressing the Bedouins and the Arabs, Palestinian Arabs in the Naqab, but it also institutions like the Jewish National Fund, who is funding these programs, and who is also trying to put a humanitarian face on the so-called development of Al-Naqab, when in fact what they're doing is confiscating Palestinian land. And the vast majority of this land, by the way, is owned by its original owners, are refugees in Gaza. These are people who were uprooted from their, you know, villages in Al-Naqab. And the Palestinian people are united today, actually, more than any other time in their history. Yes, maybe there is probably differences between Palestinian political parties. But as far as Palestinian people are concerned, they are united. We have seen this last May when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians across Palestine and in the Shatat, in diaspora, went out in the streets calling for escalating for Palestinian resistance, chanting for Palestinian resistance, and that Palestine will be free from the river to the sea.
Now, Richard, to make matters worse, as Khaled also mentioned a short while ago, recently there was a summit held between Tel Aviv and foreign ministers of Bahrain, Egypt, Morocco, and the UAE. You know, they just recently signed that normalization deal, and that drew the ire of Palestinians. So what makes these states stand by Palestinians' enemies?
Well, you know, on one hand, we should be glad to see them actually come out in the open and reveal the reality of the opposition that the Palestinians have faced for so many decades. And that is that they not only are fighting against Zionism and Israel taking over the land and U.S. imperialism and British imperialism, but also the reactionary Arab regimes. And who have pretended to be supporters of the Palestinians, who for a long time gave money in some cases or other forms of support in the hopes that that would ensure their reputations against their own population. And the population of all of these countries is not in favor of the Arab countries I'm talking about, who are being drawn into this through the Abraham Accords, as it's called, and so forth. Right. The people aren't in favor of this. The people are against it. The people sympathize with the Palestinians. But the rulers of these extremely undemocratic states, like, you know, the Kingdom of Morocco and United Arab Emirates, where only 11% of the population is allowed to be citizens, or Saudi Arabia, that just beheaded 81 people on the same day on March 12th. These are extremely reactionary governments that are proclaimed in the United States to be our friends and, you know, those who are standing for democracy. Well, they're not standing for democracy, and they're opposed to the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause, because they know how central the Palestinian cause is to the cause of the Arab people throughout the Arab nation and throughout the Arab world. And that this can bring, you know, a victory for the Palestinians would be a victory for all. And so they are very fearful. These governments are very fearful.
Mm-hmm. Khaled, well, you raised the issue, so let me ask you this question. The Arab leaders who signed the so-called normalization deals with Tel Aviv, they believe that a two-state solution should be implemented with the Israeli-occupied East Jerusalem as its capital. Is that the solution?
No, this is not the solution. In fact, they don't even believe it themselves. I mean, regardless of how rotten this so-called two-state solution is, but they don't even believe that. What they're doing now in the region is these Arab reactionary regimes and Israel are forming an alliance under the auspices and the care of the United States and, you know, U.S. imperialism. This camp is fighting another camp in the region, because this is just the reality. The region is divided into two camps. One that is pro-Zionism, colonization, these regimes who wants to maintain their power and their authority, and they are undemocratic regimes. They want to maintain their power. And there are another camp in the region, and that is the people's camp, the popular camp, and also a resistance camp. And in this camp, it's Iran, Hezbollah, the Palestinian resistance, the popular movements, the student movements, the anti-normalization movements. And as Richard mentioned, you know, the last polls, even there's by the account of their own, you know, centers, over 80% of Arab youth even reject normalization. So we know that this is a conflict, and it's part of also an international conflict, and we see how this is played. Palestine is in the center of this.
Okay, Richard, let's also hear your opinion on the two-state solution.
Well, the solution is the right of the Palestinian people. What solution there will be is the right of the Palestinian people to determine. You know, we stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people, but we do not from inside the United States pretend to give advice to the Palestinians on what to do. But I think that it's if you look, just look at a map, and you look at a map of the West Bank, and you see the vast encroachment of settlements, you have to and the complete separation from of Gaza. You know that the Israelis don't have any intention of granting anything like that. But what would it be on this point? It would require the dismantling of the settlements. And then if such a state came into being, which was discussed, the conditions that Israel always has insisted upon, fully backed by the United States, is that it would have to be a demilitarized zone, demilitarized state, in which Israel continued to control the airspace and the water resources and the borders. In other words, it would be a neo-colony. If any kind of two-state that has been put forward in the past would amount to that. But again, I want to emphasize that for those of us inside the United States, far away, we do not pretend to tell the Palestinians what the outcome of their struggle should be.
Okay. And Khaled, one last question. Given the circumstances, what, in your opinion, is the best approach for the Palestinians to adopt?
Palestinians are actually realizing that the so-called peace process path have failed. The last 30 years have been really miserable for Palestinians because they saw that Israel have engaged in a so-called peace process, and at the same time they were committing their crimes on a, you know, business as usual, confiscating Palestinian lands, saying Palestinians have no right to return to their homes, and they're using this whole scheme of peace process to actually slaughter and end and liquidate the Palestinian people, right? And now more and more Palestinians are realizing that an alternative revolutionary path is due, and that Palestinians are engaged in this path, and that is the path of liberation and return. And this would also be the bridge of a secular democratic Palestine where everyone can enjoy equal rights, but under the sovereignty of the Palestinian people.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments and input. Richard Becker in San Francisco, Khaled Barakat in Vancouver. And thank you. I'll see you next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. I have the honor and privilege of being joined by my brothers in faith and humanity. To the right, I have the one and only brother Habib. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me here. It's always an honor and a pleasure. And to my right,
assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And thank you for having me, Abdullah Al-Musawi.
Thank you so very much for joining us, gentlemen. Gentlemen, if you could just have a brief introduction of yourselves and your field of study, just for our listeners who've recently joined our program or those who've been with us for a really long time but have somehow forgotten.
Brother Habib, at your service. I'm studying in the Hawza. I've been studying for 10 years, Mashallah. Which is a long time to some extent.
To be studying anything, really.
Yeah, and...
And Brother Abdullah?
Well, I am in the same boat as Brother Habib. We kind of started together in Hawza. Maybe he was like a year before me.
I was a year before you.
Yeah. So we both students of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. And we're trying to save ourselves before we save humanity.
Ourselves is more important than
humanity. Inshallah ta'ala, of course. Thank you so very much, gentlemen. So we're just going to jump straight to the topic. What's interesting about today's gathering is that we're quite at different age ranges in our lives. Brother Habib being in his early 20s, I'm at my late 20s, Sayyid Abdullah, I believe, in his late 30s. And I think that brings a lot to the table in terms of life experiences and mindset and worldview and where we stand at our journey. I think this is a very sensitive question to be asking anyone, but Brother Habib, how often do you make mistakes?
Depending, what do you mean by mistakes?
Not as far as sins. Mistakes as in slip-ups, as in things that when you look back on, you wish I had done it differently.
Every day.
Okay. Can you highlight a certain event and consider it as perhaps the biggest mistake of your life or the biggest mistake anyone could make in their lives?
I asked you a question. I said, what do you mean by mistake? I think that it's very important for me to emphasize this factor that...
Okay, then what's your definition of it?
The meaning of mistake that I put in my mind is not always that when you do something wrong. And I mean by mistake, I mean that something I could have done better.
Interesting.
And whenever a person looks at themselves, if they see themselves, which is a good thing actually, like how Amir Mu'min alayhi salam put it, that you're in the position right now that you are better than you were before.
Mm.
You see, whatever you did before was something as like a mistake in the definition that I gave out. You could have done something better.
Right.
And I especially when I look at, for example, how I deal with some situations, especially family matters, I believe that, for example, I could have done this better. I could have done that better, for example. The way that I'm raising my kids, for example, I could have done this better. But you're gaining experience. And I always tell this to my wife that the eldest child is the poorest guy from between the bunch, right? Because we're learning on his head.
Yeah, he's like her lab rat.
Yeah, we're testing on him. And of course, experience helps, and you know, different situations also help out. And also, there's also this factor that sometimes you wish you would have not wasted your t-